Chapter 3. If it had not been for the prospect of meeting with a French or American sloop, corvette or frigate, or with a privateer, this last leg of their journey would have been a sad one. For it was, indeed, a last leg, a run that would probably take the surprise to the breaker's yard. Her officers and men, a particularly united crew, might say with perfect truth that well handled she was still one of the fastest of her class in the Navy, that her timbers were remarkably sound, and that she was a healthy as well as a happy and weatherly ship. But the fact remained that since she was built in the 1780s, frigates had grown very much larger, and they'd taken to carrying very much heavier guns. The surprise had been left behind, and she could no more set about a modern American than she could attack a line of battleship. There were still a few Frenchmen she could meet on reasonable terms, but they rarely left port, and the only real likelihood of an engagement as far as national navies were concerned was with a sloop or a corvette. There was no glory in taking a sloop or corvette, however, only disgrace in failing to do so. And the surprise pinned her hopes mainly on the privateers that did so harass the British and even the neutral trade between the old world and the new, and above all, on the notorious Spartan. Of course, there was no immortal glory in taking even an unusually heavy and powerful privateer either. But it'd be a creditable thing, a thoroughly creditable thing. And if no more splendid opponent offered, then it would round off the commission handsomely. Besides, although no ship of war, public or private, could compare with a fat merchantman in the article of vulgar tangible profit, the Spartan would still be a far from negligible prize. She was remarkably fast, recently built in an excellent yard, and if she were not too much knocked about, the Admiralty would certainly buy her into the service. Then again, there was head money, 5 quid a nob, and the Spartan was said to carry a numerous crew. They looked out for her, therefore, with more than usual zeal. And they did so in spite of the fact that many of them felt the luck had gone out of the ship. Or if not out of her, then out of her captain, which was much the same thing. The belief was strongest among those who had been fishermen or whalers, for time and again they'd seen that of two skippers with equal experience and skill, fishing the same waters with the same equipment, one would come home with full holds and the other would not. It was a question of the man's luck, a quality or rather an influence that sometimes set all one way for good or bad and sometimes shifted like a tide, but a tide whose ebb and flow obeyed laws that no ordinary men could see. The whalers held most to this belief, but it was also quite strong in a number of others, including some who had served longest in the frigate and who were most attached to her captain, Hans, who had been man-of-war's men from the beginning. There were varying creeds and some important differences of detailed belief, but broadly speaking, luck and unluck were held to have little or nothing to do with virtue or vice, amiability or its reverse. Luck was not a matter of deserts. It was a free gift, like beauty in a very young woman, independent of the person it adorned. Though just as beauty could be spoiled by frizzed hair and the like, so ill luck could certainly be provoked by given forms of conduct such as wanton pride, boasting of success, or an impious disregard for custom. Carrying parsons, for example, was unlucky. And yet, here was Mr. Martin. Reverend Martin was a good, kindly gent, not at all proud, nor above lending the doctor a hand in the sick bay or writing an official letter for a man or learning the boys to read, but he was a parson, and there was no denying it. White-handled knives were notoriously unfortunate, and so were cats, yet the voyagers started with both aboard. But such things as these, and even graver offences against the old ways of the sea, were nothing, nothing at all, in comparison with shipping a Jonah. And a Jonah had been shipped at Gibraltar in the person of Mr. Hollam, a 35-year-old master's mate. It might have been supposed that the Jonah's death would have removed the misfortune, but not at all. For a downright curse had fallen on the ship when Horner, the gunner, first killed Hollam and Mrs. Horner, they being lovers, on Juan Fernandez, and then hanged himself in his cabin some days later off the coast of Chile. Some held that the curse had been lifted when the gunner was launched over the side, sewed into his hammock with two round shot at his feet. Others did not. To the objection that the surprise had made a number of recaptures, Place, the oldest and most respected of the prophets of woe, said yes, but recaptures, though welcome, were not, as who should say, prizes. And anyhow, the last was taken just inside Admiral Pellew's command, which instantly made the poor unfortunate barkey and her poor unfortunate captain $8,000 the poorer. $8,000 bleeding! The mind could hardly conceive of such a sum. If that wasn't a curse, Joseph Place would like to know just what a curse was meant to be. Then again, the doctor, who had never been known to miss his stroke with a knife, saw, or trepanning iron, and here Place tapped his skull, where a 3-shilling piece, hammered into a dome, covered the neat hole Stephen had made on the outward voyage, had almost certainly lost his last patient, the surgeon of the Irresistible, which not only upset him cruel, but was clear proof of a curse. And if proof were wanting, they only had to look a little farther aft. What but a most uncommon curse could have brought the captain's misfortune walking into Ashgrove Cottage itself with the missus there, and perhaps Mother Williams too. Much of the talk about luck and the frigate's loss of it had been general, with people airing their views in the galley during the first or middle watch after they'd been mustered, or in the tops, or quietly on the forecastle during a make and mend. But this particular conversation was confined to men who had served with Jack from his earliest command, and who had followed him ashore during the peace and the days when he had no ship. As well-to-do bachelors, Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin had staffed Melbury Lodge entirely with seamen, and after Jack's marriage, preserved Killick, his steward, Barrett Bondon, his coxswain, Joseph Place, Bondon's cousin, and two or three more had moved on with him. They knew exactly what Ashgrove Cottage meant, having swabbed its floors, painted its woodwork, and polished its brass as though it were a ship. And, of course, they knew the entire family, from Mrs. Williams, the captain's mother-in-law, to George, the youngest of his children. But in this context, what Ashgrove Cottage meant for all of them, as it did for Jack himself, was Sophia Aubrey. All the men liked her very much indeed, but above all, they respected her to an almost religious degree. Sophie was indeed truly respectable, kind and good-looking, much more than good-looking. But since they had never come into close contact with women both amiable and respectable before, they may have set her on an even higher level than was quite right, there being something almost awful in such superiority. They also knew that she was her mother's daughter, improbable though it seemed, and that Mrs. Williams, a short, thick, dark-haired, red-faced, passionate woman, was a Tartar, one of those who had made virtue singularly unattractive. Suspected peculation, absence without leave, or fancied disrespect would rouse her to a volume of sound that seemed to mark the utmost limits of the female voice. But this was an illusion. For once unchastity in man or woman came to her attention, these bounds were left far, far behind, the remote babbling of some distant brook. To be sure, Sophie never scolded, roared, or bawled. No hard words, no turning out of doors, no assurances of eternal damnation, but she was her mother's daughter in this. Though in this alone, that she would have no truck whatsoever, with anything in the roving line. The getting of bastards might be fashionable, but it would not do for Mrs. Aubrey. Aye, said Bondon, it was a most unlucky stroke, by God. She couldn't have mistook that figurehead, though coloured somewhat dark. A damned unlucky stroke. You would think you might step aside, like, just once in a while, without having it thrown in your face 20 years later. A damned unlucky stroke. But that don't mean there's a curse on the ship. No, it only means the captain's luck is out for the moment. You may say what you like, Barrett Bondon, said Place, but I'm older than you, and I say this here Barkley's got what we call easy, Joe, said Killick, naming calls, you know. What? Asked Joe Place, who was rather deaf. Naming calls, Joe, said Killick, laying his finger to his lips. Oh, said Place, recollecting himself. That's right, mate. Yet, although Place and some others like him were determined to be apprehensive, and although everybody knew that the gunner's ghost haunted the frigate's wake, the majority were neither consistent nor glum. They reconciled the irreconcilable perhaps even more easily than landsmen. And in a ship that couldn't come to good, they looked out very eagerly for her next victim, her next success. Eagerly and cheerfully, for although they were, as Place pointed out, $8,000 the poorer because of the Admiral's share of the last recapture, there were still the earlier ships, untainted by that vile 12th. And there were, after all, the remaining 11/12 of the last, so that even allowing for the proctor's swinging fees and the other legal expenses, it was reckoned that each single share man would have £53.13 and 8 prize money, and an able seaman, nearly all the surprises were rated able, half as much again. A very charming sum indeed. Yet this didn't prevent them from longing for more. Much more. The general wish was to have enough money to set up a public house. But in practice, scarcely a man wasn't willing to settle for an additional $10 or so laid down on the capstan head with which to kick up Bob's a-dying if they touched at Fayal or anywhere else in the Azores. The Azores, however, were a great way off. And with the curiously unseasonable, baffling, light airs and calms that met the surprise a few days out of Bridgetown, they seemed determined to remain there. For once in his naval career, Captain Aubrey did not try to fly in the face of nature. In the light airs, he certainly spread noble pyramids of canvas from skyscrapers to water sails, but he didn't wet them with engine and buckets to gain a few yards in the hour, nor did he lower down the boats to tow the ship during the dead calms. The frigate proceeded soberly northeastward, or as nearly northeastward as the breezes would allow, and her captain soberly walked his quarterdeck fore and aft, 17 paces from the windward hanses to the taffrail, turn and back again, almost exactly 100 turns to the mile, to and fro, passing the hen-coops abaft the wheel and the contemplative goat Aspasia, who had laid on this deck in bitter cold and furious wind, and who now basked in the sunlight, her eyes closed, her beard nodding. Sometimes he paced off the distance between Portsmouth and Ashgrove Cottage, imagining the white road, the open country, and then the woods. But much more often he pondered anxiously about his complex affairs, legal and financial, and about Sophie's probable attitude towards him now that she'd seen Sam. As for the legal side of matters, there was little point in puzzling until he'd seen his lawyers. With no word from home, he had no more basis for an opinion now than he'd had at the beginning of the voyage. As for the financial side, these prizes would bring him in about £10,000, for which he was most profoundly grateful. It was nothing like enough to clear him of debt if things had gone against him, but it did give him room, plenty of room to turn around. And as for Sophie, on his more sanguine days, he said that she hadn't the least cause to cut up rough. In those far-off times, he'd never even seen her, much less made any promise of fidelity. She had no right to complain whatsoever. These anxious reflections about Sophie always rose up through his thoughts about mortgages and the law, when, indeed, they didn't precede them. For not only was Jack most sincerely attached to his wife, but, like his shipmates, he found a thoroughly virtuous woman an intimidating object. Just how intimidating might have been calculated from the number of times he repeated the statement about her total lack of grievance, which was sometimes accompanied by the words, "Perhaps she may even have liked him." And as for Mrs. Williams, if once she piped up, he would simply desire her never to mention the matter again. He would speak very firmly indeed as to a defaulter. Otherwise there would be no peace in the house at all. Yet these early, golden, almost windless days were not all passed in anxious thought. Very far from it. There were mornings when the ship would lie there mirrored in a perfectly unmoving, glossy sea, her sails drooping, heavy with dew, and he would dive from the rail, shattering the reflection, and swimming out and away beyond the incessant necessary din of 200 men hurrying about their duties or eating their breakfast. There he would float, with an infinity of pure sea on either hand, and the whole hemisphere of sky above already full of light. And then the sun would heave up on the eastern rim, turning the sails a brilliant white in quick succession, changing the sea to still another nameless blue, and filling his heart with joy. And there were many other things that gave him intense satisfaction. Although the Sargasso Sea lay rather more eastward than usual that year, they did pass very slowly through its western tip a little north of the tropic line, and it was wonderfully pleasant to see Stephen and Martin scrabbling about among the mats of weed and its denizens, paddled about in the jolly boat by the infinitely patient Bondon. Pleasanter still to see their shining faces as they came aboard grasping their improbable collections. He was pleased with his young gentleman, too. Circumstances had compelled him, much against his will, to take no less than 6 squeakers, some of them first voyagers of no use to man or beast. But he always had been a conscientious captain, and these being all sons of sea officers, he had determined to do his best for them. He had not only shipped a schoolmaster, but he'd made sure that his schoolmaster, who was also the chaplain, could teach them Latin and Greek. He had suffered much from his own lack of education, and he wished these boys to be literate creatures, to whom the difference between an ablative absolute and a prolative infinitive was as evident as that between a ship and a brig. He therefore supported Mr. Martin's efforts with encouragement of his own, sometimes delivered with the victim seized to a gun his bottom bare, but more often taking the form of sumptuous breakfasts in the captain's cabin or suet puddings sent below. The results were not perhaps quite all that might have been hoped for, since practical seamanship in often trying conditions had to take precedence, and it didn't seem probable that a Bentley or a Porson would burst upon an astonished world from the midshipman's berth in HMS Surprise. Yet even so, Jack could truthfully swear that the frigate had the most accomplished berth in the entire service. Often during the middle watch he would come on deck and call the reefer on duty over to join his pacing, desiring him at the same time to decline a Latin noun or conjugate a verb in Greek. "They're decent youngsters," he said. "They're reasonably well based in simple navigation, and they have a tolerable notion of seamanship, particularly Callamy and Williamson, who are such old hands. And with all his Latin and Greek, why, their own families had hardly recognised them." This was no doubt true, for in addition to the Latin and Greek, they'd learnt much about the nature of the high southern latitudes, extreme cold, short commons, and the early stages of scurvy. In the course of learning, Boyle had had three ribs stove in, Calamy had gone bald, and although he now had some downy hair, it wasn't very beautiful. Williamson had lost some toes and the tips of both ears from frostbite. Howard seemed permanently stunted, and want of teeth made him look very old, while Blakeney and Webber had suddenly shot up, all awkward in his ankles, wrists and broken voices. They were also familiar with violent death, adultery and self-murder. But the knowledge didn't seem to oppress them. They remained vapid, cheerful, very apt to race about the higher rigging like apes at play, to lie late in bed in the morning, and to neglect their duty at the least hint of fun elsewhere. He had another cause for satisfaction in the frigate's stores, so handsomely replenished in Bridgetown by the Admiral's direct insistent order. He and the boatswain and the carpenter had had to ponder so heavily over the use of a few fathoms of cordage or a couple of deals for so long that it was a sensuous delight to move about among the bales, coils and casks, smelling pitch, paint, new rope and sailcloth and freshly sawn wood. He'd also laid in supplies of his own, so that he was able to return to his round of dinners, inviting his officers with a certain style in the traditional way. He liked all his officers, and he revered the traditions of the service. But his cause for satisfaction was, of course, his ship. It seemed to him that she had never sailed so sweetly, and that her people had never worked so well and heartily together. He knew that this was almost certainly the last leg of her last voyage, but he'd known that she was mortal for a great while now, and the knowledge had become a kind of quiet heartbreak, always in the background, so that at present he took very particular notice of her excellence and of each day he passed on her. Each day had its own character. It couldn't be otherwise at sea. But during this early calm progress, before the frigate picked up the westerlies, they were wonderfully alike. The immemorial sequence of cleaning the upper decks in the earliest morning, pumping ship, piping up hammocks, piping hands to breakfast, cleaning the main deck, piping to the various morning exercises, the solemn observation of noon, hands piped to dinner, grog piped up, the officers drummed to the gunroom dinner, the afternoon occupations, hands piped to supper, more grog, then quarters, with the thunderous great guns flashing and roaring in the twilight. The immemorial sequence, punctuated by bells, was so quickly and firmly restored that it might never have been broken. This was the sort of sailing everybody was used to. And now that the agent victualler in Bridgetown had done his duty by them, this was the diet that everybody was used to as well. There were no more dolphin sausages served out to confound the mind and the calendar. No more imperfectly smoked penguins. But the regular and natural succession of salt pork, dried peas, salt beef, more dried peas, more salt pork. So that the days, though so much alike, could be told apart in a moment from the smell of the galley coppers. It all gave a pleasant illusion of eternity, this quiet sailing under a perfect sky towards a horizon perpetually 5 miles ahead, never nearer. But at the same time, every man aboard, apart from the Gibraltar lunatics and one home-grown innocent called Henry, knew that there was no permanence about it at all. For one thing, the paying-off pennant was already being prepared. A splendid silk streamer, the length of the ship and more, that was to be hoisted the day she went out of commission, and all her people paid at last changed from members of a tight-knit community to solitary individuals. For another, since everybody was determined that if the barkie were to be laid up in ordinary, or if she were to go to the breaker's yard, then she should go in style. They spent a great deal of their time beautifying her. She'd been much battered south of the Horn, and all that Mr. Mowat had screwed out of the Bridgetown yard and all that he'd bought out of his own pocket, best gold leaf and two pots of vermilion, would hardly be enough to bring her to full perfection. Given the surprise's very high standards and her first lieutenant's love of perfection, the prettying and the pennant would in any case have been difficult and time-consuming. They were rendered very much more so by the frigate's deck cargo and side cloths. These were designed to give her the appearance of a merchantman, and the first was made up of empty casks that could eventually be knocked down and used for firewood, while the second were long strips of cloth painted with the likeness of gunports and fastened along the frigate's sides, covering her real gunports, and giving a fine impression of falsity, particularly when they rippled in the breeze. The Surprises had long been used to their captain's ways, and they took great delight in this disguise. There was something piratical about it, and something of the biter bit, or to be bit, that pleased their very souls. And although the Spartan, a far-ranging privateer, could scarcely be expected for several hundred miles, they worked double tides on the painted port lids, going over them again and again to get them just wrong, just a little too large and out of true, so that a sharp, predatory eye should pride itself on seeing through the deceit and close without hesitation. Nor did they make the least objection to striking down the deck cargo in order to make a clean sweep fore and aft every evening for quarters. This was Jack's favourite time of the day, and the time when he was proudest to be ship and her people. He'd always been a great believer in gunnery, and at great cost in time, spirit and private powder, he'd trained his gun crews to something very near the highest pitch of efficiency their instruments allowed. At different times, the Surprise had been armed in different ways. At one point, she'd carried almost nothing but carronades, short, light guns that shot a very heavy ball for a very small charge of powder, so that with her 24 32-pounders and her 8 18-pounders, she could throw a broadside of no less than 456 pounds, more than the gun deck of a line-of-battle ship. But she couldn't throw them very far nor very accurately. And although these carronades, these smashers, as they were called, were wonderfully effective at close quarters so long as they didn't overturn or set the ship's sides on fire because of their shortness, Jack didn't think much of them for blue water sailing. At close quarters he preferred boarding to battering, and at a distance he preferred the fine work of exact, very carefully aimed gunfire in rippling broadsides. At present, the frigate carried 22 12-pounders on her main deck and two beautiful brass long nines, Captain Aubrey's private property, the gift of a grateful Turk, that might be fitted in the chase ports below or that might, in suitable weather, take the place of the two forecastle carronades. She possessed six 24-pounder carronades, but since they tended to oppress her in heavy seas, they were often struck down into the hold. And in any case, it was the cannon, the real guns that Jack Aubrey loved. With them, he could only command a broadside of 141 pounds, but he knew very well that even 100 weight of iron hitting a ship in the right place could wound her terribly. And like a fair number of other commanders, his friend Philip Brooke, for example, he was convinced of the truth of Collingwood's dictum: if a ship can fire three well-directed broadsides in 5 minutes, no enemy can resist them. By dint of long, arduous and costly training, he'd brought this figure down to three broadsides in 3 minutes 10 seconds. The training was costly in the most obvious sense, for in this matter, as in many others, the Admiralty didn't see eye to eye with Captain Aubrey, and the regulations allowed him only a pitiful amount of powder apart from that blazed away in action. All the rest had to be supplied by him, and at the present rate a broadside cost close on a guinea. For some little time after they'd left the last of the Sargasso weed astern, the evening exercise had consisted of no more than dumb show, of heaving the great guns in and out and going through the motions of firing them. But Thursday was Sophie's birthday, and her husband meant to make the heavens ring by way of celebrating it. Furthermore, the conditions were almost ideal. A t'gallant breeze in the southwest, an easy, moderate swell, and he hoped the ship might beat her record. Like most records, it had something artificial about it. Long before the drum beat for quarters, the men knew that they were going to fire in earnest, since they'd heard the captain tell the first lieutenant to have a raft and 3 beef barrels and a red flag prepared. Yet, although there was nothing spontaneous or unexpected about the simulated battle, they took their attempt upon the record very seriously. The crew of the brass chasers, for example, spent a good deal of their watch below in going over the 9-pound balls with a hammer, removing irregularities. For these long, accurate guns had very little windage, and they called for glass-smooth round-shot. Once the preliminaries were over, once the drum had beat, once the disguise had been cleared away, once all the cabin bulkheads had been knocked down so that there should be a clean sweep fore and aft, with the decks wetted and sanded, damp fear-not screens over the hatchways to the magazine, and all hands at their action stations, the pigtailed members of the gun crews, and that was most of them, the surprise following the old days, doubled their cues and tied them short. Some took off their shirts, and many knotted a handkerchief round their foreheads against the sweat. They stood easy, each in a place he knew intimately well, with his own particular tackle-fall, rammer, sponge, powder-horn, wad, handspike, crow or round-shot just at hand, the lieutenants behind their divisions, and the midshipmen behind their groups of guns. And they watched the blue cutter towing the raft away over the sea. The breeze hummed gently through the rigging. Smoke from the slow match in the tubs wafted here and there about the deck. In the silence, Jack's words to the master were heard clearly on the forecastle. "Mr. Allen, we will haul our wind 2 points, if you please. Mr. Callamere, jump down to the orlop and ask the doctor, with my compliments, for the loan of his watch." The surprise turned to larboard. The cutter reappeared, casting off her tow. Tension mounted, and the men spat on their hands or hitched their trousers. Then came the ritual words, "Silence fore and aft. Cast loose your guns. Level your guns. Out, tompions. Run out your guns." And here there was a universal roar as 18 tons of metal were heaved out as fast as they could go. "Prime! Fire from forward as they bear!" The target was bobbing out there on the flashing sea, well beyond the accurate reach of carronades. Bondon, the captain of Number 2, the starboard chaser, crouched over his piece, glaring along the barrel. The elevation was right, but to point it true, he made little jerks of his head to the men with the crow on one side and the handspike on the other, they standing with their backs to the ship's side, to heave the 1.5 tons of brass a trifle one way or another. The long brass gun in the broad bowport could be trained very far forward, and presently Bondon had the target full over his dispart sight. But he was as eager as his captain to beat the record, and he wouldn't fire until the Number 4 gun on his right, Willful Murder by name, should also have it clear. Unbreathing moments, 2 heaves of the long, slow swell, and then the murmur from Willful Murder, "Whenever you like, mate." Bondon reached out his hand for the glowing match and clapped the pink end down on the touch-hole, arching his body to let the instantly recoiling gun shoot inboard under him. They were scarcely aware of the enormous ringing crack and the jet of flame, the flying bits of wad, the smoke and the twang of the breaching. They took them for granted as they held the gun firm, sponged it, ran the cartridge home, the ball and the wad, and ran the piece up again with a satisfying thump. Took them as much for granted as the deeper report of number 4, instantly followed by Towser, number 6, and so on in double-quick time to 22 and 24, Jumping Billy and True Blue, which were in Jack's sleeping place and great cabin, respectively. Or as the dense white smoke that eddied in the breeze. But their motions, though extremely rapid, exact and powerful, were so nearly automatic that most of the crew had time to see the flight of their ball and the fountain of water as it pitched just under the target. A hair's breadth, a hair's breadth, muttered Bondon, bent over the reloaded pointed gun, and then he whipped the glowing match across. On the quarterdeck, Jack stood holding Stephen's watch, a fine Breguet with a centre seconds hand, and he craned to rise above the smoke of the present broadside. The first had covered the target with white water, not a single ball badly astray. This one was even better, sending two of the barrels and most of the raft into the air. Well done, my God, he cried, very nearly pounding the watch to pieces on the rail. He checked himself and passed it to Calamy, his aide-de-camp. Note, the very second 24 is fired, he said, and skipped from a cannonade slide into the lower shrouds to see the fall of the next discharge. The broadside began as the ship rose under him almost to the height of the roll, and it reached 24 before she'd heeled back half a stroke. A long, roaring peal, a bank of smoke pierced through with lightning stabs, and beyond it all the flight of the shot, as pretty a grouping as he'd ever seen, all close together, all well pitched up, leaving nothing of the target whatsoever. He jumped down onto the deck and looked at Calamy, who replied with a grin, 3 minutes and 8 seconds, sir, if you please. Jack laughed with pleasure. We've done it, he said. Yet what I really value is the accuracy. Any fool can bang off quick, but this was deadly, deadly. He walked along the line of guns and their jolly, sweating crews, particularly commending the captains of Viper, Mad Anthony, Bulldog and Nancy's Fancy for their briskness, but warning them that if they grew any brisker, it would be a simultaneous discharge. The guns would all go off together, and that would never do. Her timbers wouldn't stand it. Now they'd fall apart. And he'd far rather they stayed together in case they should see this heavy privateer, the Spartan. They saw her 3 times. A little before dawn, no more than 3 days after this outstanding exercise, Mr. Honey, the officer of the watch, sent a lookout to the masthead as usual, this being the very best time for finding an enemy close at hand, stronger or weaker as the case might be. It had been a thick, murky night, and there were still veils of mist turning and drifting on the breeze when the man hailed the deck. A sail! A sail to leeward! "Where away?" called Honey, who could see nothing from the deck. "Right on our beam, sir," came the answer. "But I can't make her out any more. A ship, I think, maybe a long mile away."
"She's the Spartan for sure," said Awkward Davies to his mate over the enormous padded stone called a bear they were scouring the deck with. "You can take my word for it. John Larkin's seen the Spartan. John Larkin's always been the lucky cove."
Honey sent his midshipman to tell Mowat, and Jack, stirring in his cot, heard an elderly Italian seaman just by the skylight say to another, "John Larkin him see Spartano." By the time Jack reached the deck, Mowat, still in his nightshirt, had descended billowing from the top, and he said with a beaming face, "Sir, I was just about to send to ask permission to alter course and make sail. There's a sail to leeward, and Larkin thinks it might be the privateer." "Ha!" said several of the men on the gangway, their swabs idle in their hands. "Very well, Mr. Mowat," said Jack. "Alter course by all means. And perhaps at the same time you might induce the watch to do a little towards prettying the deck. The King doesn't pay them for their beauty alone, and it would be a pity to speak this privateer, if privateer she be, in such a state of unspeakable squalor, to be seen even by foreigners looking like Sodom and Gomorrah." Privateer she was, but she was not the Spartan. Indeed, she was not a foreigner at all, but the Prudence, a 12-gun brig out of Kingston. As soon as the sun had burnt off the haze, she backed to her foretopsail and lay to. And when the Surprise was within hailing distance, her master came across with her papers. He ran up the side and saluted the quarterdeck, navy fashion. A man in a plain blue coat about Jack's age. He was obviously ill at ease, and at first Jack put this down to his anxiety about having his men pressed. But it persisted even after Jack had remarked that he had no need of any more hands. And when some time had passed, Jack perceived that it arose from a fear of being recognised and of not being acknowledged. "I had no idea I'd ever seen him at first," he said, when he and Stephen were tuning their strings that evening. "No notion at all until he threw out a hint about recognising the old Surprise with her 36-gun ship's mainmast right away, and then I smoked it. He was the same Ellis that had commanded the Hind 18, a King's ship, and I'd seen him half a dozen times at the Cape. This is a sad come-down for him, of course, rather as it was for the men I spoke of when we were telling Parson Martin about privateers. Though in this case, I'm afraid there was a court-martial. I forget the details. Something to do with bills drawn on the Navy Board, I believe. Not very pretty. But we got along famously once I'd recollected who he was, and he told me a good deal about the Spartan. We're not likely to see her this side of the Azores, I fear.
Mr. Allen's duty, sir, said the dwarvish Howard, hurrying in, and there are the lights of 4 sail of ships, 3 points on the starboard bow.
Howard's want of teeth made him hard to understand, but in time his message came through, and Jack said, yes, those are the West Indiaman the privateer was speaking of. Let them be given 2 blue lights and a windward gun. The gun went off, and it could be heard being made fast again. But still Jack sat on, his fiddle drooping in his hand. "You're in a fine study, brother," said Stephen, not unkindly, when he'd been waiting a very long while. "Lord, yes," cried Jack, "I do beg your pardon. It's that I was just wondering whether the infernal ptarmigan was there when Sam called at Ashgrove Cottage. Not that it really signifies, however." "Certainly not." Stephen played a phrase. Jack replied with a variation, and so they handed it to and fro, playing sometimes separately, sometimes together, hunting it through a great number of forms until the pattern worked out in a fine, satisfying close with both in unison. And at this point, their toasted cheese came in. "In England, I find," said Stephen after a while, "cranes are called herons, and there are many other differences. As an Englishman, pray, how would you define a ptarmigan now?" "Why, ptarmigans are those contentious, froward, crossover-bearing women you come across only too often. Lady Bates is one, so is Mrs. Miller. They're called after Mahomet's wife, I believe. Or at least that was what my old father told me when I was a boy." Had General Aubrey confined himself to etymology, however bold, he would have done his son no harm. But he'd seen fit to go into politics as an opposition member for various rotten boroughs. And since he was a man of weak understanding but inexhaustible energy, his perpetual vehement harrying of the ministry had made even his Tory connections objects of dislike or suspicion. He was now associated with the least reputable members of the radical movement. Not because he wished to see the slightest reform of Parliament or anything else, but because, in his folly, he still imagined that the ministry would give him some plum, such as a colonial governorship, to shut his mouth. He also thought that some of his radical friends were devilish clever money-making fellows, and he was intensely eager, indeed avid, for wealth. Stephen had met Jack's father, a really dangerous parent, and the wish that the general might choke to death on his next bite fleeted through his mind. But he passed the toasted cheese in silence,
and soon after they played a very gentle lament he'd learnt in the city of Cork from Hempson, the great harper of the world, when he was 104. The second Spartan they saw was, in fact, just this side of the Azores, plumb to windward, within 100 miles of the place where she had taken Pullings and the Danae in chase. And just as Pullings had said in his letter, she was so like a Portuguese man-of-war that at a mile even an old experienced hand would have sworn she was all she seemed. Everything was right. Colours, officers' uniforms, even the gilded crucifix catching the sun on the quarter-deck. The old experienced hand would still have sworn it at half a mile. And Captain Aubrey and Mr. Allen, who had been standing there side by side with their telescopes fixed on the approaching ship while the keen smell of slow match wafted about them, and hands stood by to cast off the cloths masking the loaded guns, turned to one another with the same expression of dawning comprehension, surprise, disappointment, and relief. "Thank God we never fired you," said the master. Jack nodded and cried, "Douse the match there, douse the match! Mr. Mowat, pennant and colours." The Portuguese hail came across the water, somewhat testy, and he went on, "Mr. Allen, pray reply," for the master was fluent in Portuguese, "and ask the captain to dine with me." The Portuguese captain would not dine, but he did accept Jack's apologies and explanation with a good grace. They split a bottle of capital white port in his cabin, and Jack learnt that although there were two American privateers in the harbour of Fayal, neither was the Spartan nor anything like her size. She had been seen in these waters, but the Portuguese thought she'd probably borne away for the Guinea coast, unless conceivably she was lying far to the eastward, looking out for some of your fat West Indiaman with the full moon to chase them in, he said with a chuckle, for he loved a prize as much as any man living. The full moon was indeed no great way off, and its increase tended to swallow the wind, so that by the time the surprise saw her third Spartan, well to the east of Terceira, the Atlantic looked as harmless as the Serpentine, ruffled here and there with light airs and varying breezes. She appeared as ships so often did from a morning bank of haze. She was lying there to the northward, hull up from the quarterdeck, on the frigate's starboard bow, and she too was on the larboard tack. At first she met with little credit. The starboard watch, red-legged from cleaning the decks with water that was now quite cold, was sick of this here so-called privateer, sick of his goddamn deck cargo and his bloody sidecloths. It was far too late to come across any Spartan now, and they wanted their breakfast. Jack, staring out over the sea from the main top, was much of their opinion. But he did think it worthwhile to call down that hammocks were not to be piped up and that the watch below was to stay there until further orders. As the light strengthened, he was glad he'd done so. His very recent experience of a Portuguese man-of-war made the Spartan's disguise, for this was the true, the genuine privateer, less convincing. And in any case, the ship over there answered exactly to Pulling's description. A tall ship with massive spars, no doubt, very fast indeed, and capable of throwing a shockingly heavy broadside, at least at close quarters. On seeing the surprise, she had at once clapped a helm alee, and this seemed to Jack profoundly significant, since it would in time give her the weather gauge. A real Portuguese, with no more than a discretionary duty to inspect, wouldn't go to so much trouble. Wouldn't undertake a move which at this distance and in these light airs could come to good only after hours of careful manoeuvring. Jack steered a corresponding course, and as he took his breakfast in the top, he watched her with unremitting attention. By his last cup of coffee, he was perfectly convinced of her identity, and his conviction had communicated itself to the crew.
From time to time, he sent still more men below, so as to reduce his visible crew as nearly to the size of a merchantman's as he could. A difficult task, since at the same time he needed enough hands to make sail and brace round the heavy yards as quickly as the privateer, which, he saw, was very well manned indeed. The larboard watch, at first delighted with the idea of the starbolins doing all the cold, wet work on deck while they lay like lords in their hammocks, soon became uneasy. Then, as more starbolins were sent below, almost desperate. On the lower deck, there were, of course, no ports nor even scuttles, and they were obliged to rely on reports delivered down the forehatchway by their happier companions. Ships in the Royal Navy differed enormously in the matter of discipline. There were some in which two men could hardly be seen talking together quietly without being put down as malcontents, perhaps potential mutineers, and reported by the master-at-arms. The surprise was nothing remotely like any of those unhappy vessels, but even so prolonged conversation on duty was not encouraged, especially at a time when exceedingly delicate operations were in hand. The accounts that came down the hatchway were, therefore, sparse and fragmentary. But uttered by seamen for seamen, they gave the broad picture quite accurately. The two ships lay north and south of one another, and although there were odd catspaws and small local breezes from other quarters, the undoubted general movement of the air was from the westward, and there were signs that in time, perhaps tomorrow, it might freshen. The aim of each captain was to get the weather gauge. That is to say, to gain a position westward of the other, so that he might come down with the breeze on his best point of sailing and force the engagement at the moment and in the conditions most favourable for himself, rather than undertake a long and perhaps inconclusive windward chase with the continual possibility of having an important spar knocked away by gunfire or carried away by the breeze. But each wished his manoeuvre to seem unstudied, a natural part of his ordinary, peaceful voyage, so that his unsuspecting, unhurrying adversary should let himself be outstripped, thinking no harm. This added a fresh dimension to the snail-paced but strenuous race to windward, in which every vagrant puff had to be wooed and embraced by all the canvas that could be spread. But it was one that set the surprise at a disadvantage to begin with, since in her character as a prudent merchantman she had no royal masts above her stamped t'gallants, and they could hardly be sent up man-of-war fashion without exciting suspicion. Nor could royals, skysails, moonsails, stargazers and other flying kites, all very useful in these mere zephyrs where the higher air moved somewhat faster than that just over the sea. The masts and yards were sent up in time, and the lofty sails were set upon them. But in the meanwhile the Spartan, profiting by a northwestern slant of wind, had come half a mile closer. This didn't suit Jack's book at all. He didn't want his ship or his people to be wounded or killed for the sake of a privateer. What he hoped to do was to gain a decided advantage in beating up to the west, and then, with the Spartan under his lee and well within reach of his long guns, to throw off his disguise, send a shot across her bows, and await her surrender. If it didn't come directly, then a couple of broadsides should certainly bring it. But if this present advance went on, the privateer would be laying him aboard, and there'd be a general melee, the Spartan's 42-pound carronades coming into play, with the ship being hurt and a great many people wounded. Looking very keenly at the catspaw travelling over the smooth surface and bearing the Spartan with it, Jack leaned over the top rim and called down his orders. The Surprise turned gently to starboard, glided across towards the Spartan to within random shot, picked up the cat's paw as it left her and went about, staying with a smooth perfection. For 10 or 15 minutes the Surprise ran, fast enough to make the water ripple along her side, leaving the Spartan with all her sails limp, barely capable of steering. By the time the breeze left the frigate too, the balance had been restored. This was reported to the men below, and Faster Doodle, an old and knowing hand, observed that now they could settle down to a luffing match in peace. The skipper need fear no one in a luffing match. And as for sailing on a bowl in the bark, he had no equal. She'd eat the wind out of anything afloat by the end of the day. It was a luffing match, certainly, with each ship trimming its sails with infinite attention and sailing wonderfully close to what wind there was, with bowlines twanging taut. But it was also much more, with each ship moving from her windward line, sometimes perilously far, in search of one of the vagrant breezes that passed across the sea, often under the fat cushions of cloud. And then there were the moves intended to deceive, such as paying off to gather impetus, putting the helm alee with hands at their stations for going about, and even letting the headsail shiver as though the ship were on the very point of tacking, but then flatting in the jib and foretopmast staysail, falling off and carrying on as before, the intention being that the other ship, carrying out the same manoeuvre, should either hang in stays on seeing her error and so lose time, or go about briskly and lose still more time getting back onto the original tack. By the late afternoon, a hot, damp, oppressive afternoon, each captain had a distinct notion of his opponent's capabilities. It was clear to Jack that the other fellow was a thorough seaman, cunning, devious, and up to every kind of duplicity, and that his ship, at least in light airs, was almost a match for the Surprise. Almost, but not quite. For when the sun began to sink towards the horizon, swallowing even the lightest airs, so that the sea was glass from rim to rim, the Surprise had gained perhaps a quarter of a mile of windward distance, and Jack felt reasonably confident that if the breeze revived with the setting of the sun, which was probable, he could increase this lead by the amount required to cover the mile or so separating them, for they'd been sailing on parallel tacks until the wind fell quite away, place the Spartan directly under his lee, and so call upon her to surrender. But for this the breeze had to revive. And although the Surprise's people, starting with her captain, whistled and scratched backstays, never a breath did they raise. Nothing whatsoever broke the surface of the sea, not the heave of a distant whale, nor a flight of flying fish, though half a dozen had been picked up on the gangway yesterday evening, nor the slightest ripple of a moving air. And the ships lay there motionless, both with their heads to the north, the Surprise looking at the Spartan's larboard quarter. You might ask the doctor and Mr. Martin whether they would like to see a perfect clock calm, said Jack to his coxswain, who was in the main top with him. Perhaps their whistling might do something to change it. When Bondon came back, he found some difficulty in delivering his message. Both gents, it seemed, were profiting by this splendid freedom from motion to spread their important collections of Brazilian and Polynesian coleoptera out in the gunroom. Bondon had unfortunately trodden upon some and swept others to the ground as he recoiled. The gents had answered rather testy, even the chaplain. They would whistle if so required, and would even scratch a backstay like idolatrous heathens if the implement were pointed out, but unless the captain absolutely desired it, they begged to be excused. They had far rather not leave their beetles now. Well, began Jack, smiling. It was only a... He broke off and clapped his telescope to his eye. They're hooking yards and stays to lower boats, he said. And a few moments later, the Spartan's yawl splashed down, picked up a line from the bows and towed the ship's head round until she was broadside on to the Surprise. After a careful pause, she fired one of her heavy carronades. Jack saw the captain point the gun at full elevation and pull the lanyard. The ball grazed the smooth surface and came skipping over the sea towards the surprise in great leaps. It kept a wonderfully true line, but the range was too great and the ball sank at the 10th rebound, a little after the sound of its firing had reached the ship. It was clear that the privateer's captain was still convinced of the frigate's innocence, and that he meant to finish things out of hand in case the coming breeze should enable her to work still farther to windward. He meant first to intimidate her with his heavy ball, and then to overcome her by towing his ship within killing range and boarding with his boats. The others were ready for lowering. "All hands!" called Jack in a strong but not unexpected voice, and the seamen below rushed up from their odious leisure. This was followed by a quick succession of orders, and Martin said to Stephen, "How they do run about, to be sure! What are those little groups beyond the teapot?" "They're duplicates for Sir Joseph Blaine. You've mentioned Sir Joseph before, but I don't believe you've ever told me who he is," said Martin, looking a little jealously at a dynasty's imperator of which he had only two examples. "His daily bread is Whitehall," said Stephen, "but his delight is entomology, and he has a fine cabinet of rarities. He was one of the vice-presidents of the Entomological Association last year. I'll introduce you when next we're in town. I trust I shall see him quite soon after landing." "Amen, amen, amen," he said privately with some warmth, for that vile brass box and its monstrous uneasy wealth preyed upon his waking and his sleeping mind. "Casks over the side," called Jack. "Cast off the sidecloths. Mr. Mowat, when is that boat going to be hoisted out?" "Directly, sir, directly," cried Mowat from the gangway, but for once the ship's efficiency failed her. The pin of a block had broken, the tackle was hopelessly jammed, and in spite of the boatswain's furious efforts, the boat hung dismally from a single ring until the second cutter was bundled unceremoniously over the quarter. In the meantime, and to his intense vexation, Jack saw the farther sea, the northern sea, ruffling with a breeze coming fast from the west. It reached the Spartan, and filled with suspicion, she swung round to bring it on to her larboard quarter, veering the yawl astern as she moved away eastward faster and faster, her people bracing round the yards with extraordinary activity. "Maintop, colours on the short pennant," cried Jack. "Master Gunner, put me a ball across her bows, and another through her mainsail if that don't stop her." In the present position, the starboard chaser was the only gun that could bear, but in any case Jack wouldn't have used his broadside to begin with. Quite apart from killing people unnecessarily, he had no wish to maul the privateer and then spend days knotting and splicing. If she didn't strike and lie to, however, he'd have to do so. And all that was needed for the murderous discharge was swinging the ship 6 points, a simple matter in a sea as smooth as silk. A simple matter but for awkward Davies. The blue cutter had been launched over the side by main force and had shipped a great deal of water in the process, but the crew took no notice of the bath they sat in and pulled furiously ahead to pick up the tow line. Davies at stroke oar caught it. The cutter pulled on a few strokes to take in the slack, and then Davies stood up. His dark, fierce, brutal face was set. A line of white showed between his lips and his eyes were ablaze. Taking no notice of Howard's squeaking orders, he set his foot on the gunwale and gave an enormous heave. The boat instantly tilted, filled, and sank. Few of the cutter's crew could swim, and the situation was complicated by other people also unable to swim plunging in after them. By the time they'd all been brought aboard, some of them pretty far gone, and by the time the ship had at last been swung round, the Spartan was a great way off. She'd seen the horrid accuracy of the chaser. She'd seen the long row of unmasked guns and the sudden swarm of men about her decks. She didn't mean to wait for any further proof, and she was already rigging out her weather stunsail booms. "Fire high," said Jack, dripping onto his quarter-deck. He'd fished out the wretched Davies as well as little Howard for the third or even fourth time in their long acquaintance. "Fire high and let the smoke clear between each shot." No. The broadside speckled the sea in the Spartan's wake, short and poorly grouped. "How's your guns?" he said.
and they did so, looking at him nervously. But this was no time for recrimination, with the Spartan already making better than 5 knots, a cable's length farther away every minute, and the breeze, the steady breeze this time, spreading south to reach the Surprise. He studied the course of the wind with the keenest attention, unaware of the towel, the dry shirt and coat that Killick held out, mute for once, and he called, "Man the 4 clue garnets!" His mind was wholly concerned with making up these lost miles, for not only had the Spartan gained this flying start, but all the Surprise's former gain was now so much handicap. The first high gusts reached the frigate's royals and skysails. She swung round, she gathered steerage way, and as the sun went down, turning her nascent wake blood red, he began to make sail. Hitherto, she'd been beating up with an array of sharply braced square sails and staysails, reaching almost to the sky. Now, she was to have the breeze on her quarter, or very near, and he set stunsails aloft and alow, with a ringtail to the driver, bonnets, of course, and save-alls under the stunsails, and even the driver boom. Brought the foretack to the cathead with a passeree, cast off the main tack, and hauled the weather clew of the main course to the yard. All the hands, from the miserable Davies to the wholly irreproachable Bondon, seemed to be suffering from a sense of collective guilt, and his cold, impersonal, objective orders, with never an oath or a hasty word, designed solely to get the last ounce of thrust out of the breeze, quite daunted them. They hurried about in dead silence with anxious faces, and when he ordered the fire engine into the top so that the sails being wetted might draw better, they pumped with such force that the jet reached beyond the royals, which ordinarily called for buckets, sent up with a whip. In the darkening twilight, he concentrated all his powers on the exact trim of sails and braces, and presently the ship began to speak. Her cutwater split a distinct bow wave, and innumerable small bubbles ran down her side with a continuous hiss, while the slightly increasing wind hummed and sang in the rigging. The moon rose directly ahead, and in her path he saw the Spartan, a magnificent wide-winged spread of canvas like a distant bird. A distant bird, but no more distant than she had been a little while ago. She was no longer obviously gaining. He loosened his very strong grip of the fife rail, yawned from hunger, and glanced fore and aft. Over to leeward he was aware of Stephen and Martin smiling at him as though willing to be spoken to. "You're too late for the clock, Calm," he said, remembering that he'd sent to them long ago. "There's a light air from the west at present, and with any luck it may grow into a breeze." "We're sorry about the Calm," said Stephen, "but we thought you might like to view our beetles. They're now fully set out for the first time, most gratifying sight, covering the entire table and the floor. It cannot last, however, the gentlemen of the gunroom being so impatient for their supper." "That would give me great pleasure," said Jack, with a last searching look under the mainsail to the fully drawing forecourse. "And if the gunroom, after the bugs, of course, would invite me to take a bite of bread and cheese, how happy I should be. Mr. Merritt, pray have the hands piped to supper at last, watch by watch, and tell Killick to rouse me up an elbow-chair, my broad night-glass and a boat-cloak. The dew is falling, so the engine may leave off." In this chair, wrapped in his cloak, he spent the long, moonlit night, rising at every bell to walk along the gangway to the forecastle and out along the bowsprit to peer at the Spartan with his night-glass between the spritsail course and its topsail. She was maintaining her lead, possibly increasing it, and she was obviously a flyer commanded by a very able man. But Jack had the feeling that she wouldn't be so happy in heavy weather, and if only the west wind would come on to blow as it sometimes did in these waters, he believed the Surprise would close with her. Apart from anything else, he had a way of enabling her to bear an extraordinary press of sail, particularly with the wind abaft the beam. He sent light hawsers and cablets to the mastheads,
and although they made the ship look barbarously ugly, they did keep her masts standing, where in another ship with the same thrust acting on her, they would have carried away, shrouds, backstays, preventer backstays and all. The moon sailed across the pure sky, and the pale stars in their due sequence. The ship followed her nightly routine with the same kind of ordered regularity. The log was heaved, 5 knots to 5 knots, 2 fathoms, no more. The logboard marked by the glow of the binnacle. The depth of water in the well reported. The glass was turned, the bell struck, the helm relieved. And all round the ship the lookouts cried, "All's well!" At 4 bells in the middle watch, the breeze hauled a little forward, so that Jack filled the mainsail. But apart from that, both ships raced over the sea with never a change, as though they were running in a timeless dream. A little before dawn, with the moon right low astern, Mars blazing in the east, and the head pump already setting the forecastle awash for the swabbers, the sharp scent of coffee pierced through his reflections. He walked into his lit cabin, and with half-closed eyes he looked at the quicksilver in the glass. It hadn't actually gone down, but the top of the column was concave rather than the other way about. There was at least a reasonable hope of wind. Killick brought him the pot and some very old rye bread toasted, and asked in a subdued, dutiful tone whether there was anything else he'd like. "Not for the moment," said Jack. "I suppose the doctor's not about." "Oh, no, sir." Stephen was a bad sleeper, but he disapproved of the habitual use of soporifics on medical and moral grounds, and he usually delayed the taking of his pill or draught until 2 in the morning, so that he was rarely to be seen before 8 or 9 o'clock. "When he's up, say that I should be happy to see him and Mr. Martin to dinner, wind and weather permitting, and pass the word for the officer of the watch." "Mr. Allen," he said to that officer, "I shall turn in for a few hours, but I'm to be called at the slightest change, either in the weather or the chase." "A few hours," he said, and they carefully refrained from any noise abaft the mizzenmast, cleaning the deck only with silent swabs. But at the changing of the watch, there he was, stalking forward to stare at the chase in the brilliant morning. She was almost exactly the same, only sunlit rather than moonlit. She had perhaps drawn a little ahead, but she'd not altered her sails. There was indeed very little she could add. And what was more important, she hadn't deviated half a degree from her course northeast by east. The night's chase had been dreamlike. The day's was scarcely less so. For although there was the prevailing sense of urgency and even crisis, and although there was the engine in the top squirting with all its might, while the brass long nines stood ready on the forecastle, trained right forward with their garlands of smooth shot beside them, there was remarkably little to do. With the perfect steadiness of the breeze, it was like rolling down the trades to the Cape, never touching sheet or brace for days and even weeks on end. But whereas in the trades there was always cleaning, painting ship, washing clothes, making and mending, and the many forms of exercise, to say nothing of church and divisions, here nothing was appropriate but the making of wads and the chipping of round shot. And so, to the click, click of 50 or 60 hammers, the Surprise ran on, going as fast as the most careful attention to brace and helm could drive her, pursuing a chase that lay perpetually halfway to a horizon that perpetually receded before them both. It was to the distant accompaniment of this sound that Jack and his guests at their dinner. Shaved and shining after a catnap, Jack was in fine form. Yesterday's intense frustration belonged to history. He hadn't felt so well or so alive since the horrible days of the court-martial, and he enjoyed his company. Neither Stephen nor Martin was a sailor, nor indeed anything remotely like a sailor. Neither believed in the sacred majesty of a post-captain, and both talked quite freely. A great relief. Furthermore, the glass was sinking, a sure sign of wind,
and throughout the meal the steady chipping of shot told him that all was well on deck. A chase in sight, his ship in perfect order, and a blow coming on. This was real sailoring. This was why men went to sea. It is true that the chaplain's presence was usually something of a constraint upon him, and that since the appearance of Sam, his troubled conscience had made Jack almost mealy-mouthed when they conversed. But today an abundance of vitality thrust conscience to one side, and they talked away in a very pleasant manner. He told them that he was now quite sure the privateer was running for Brest, which was one of her home ports, that he hoped they might come up with her long before Ushant and its tangle of inshore reefs and islands, but there was no certainty of it at all. The chase had shown no signs of distress. She hadn't started her water over the side, still less her boats and guns. But from the look in his bright blue, cheerfully predatory eye, both his listeners concluded that his unspoken mind was less reserved, less cautious towards fate. Martin said he supposed that the engine, pumping with such force upon the sails, striking them from behind, as it were, must urge the boat along and so increase its speed. "There cannot be the least doubt of it," said Stephen. "When virtue spooms before a prosperous gale, my heaving wishes help to fill the sail," says Dryden, that prince of poets, and the dear knows we spoom in the most virtuous manner. "I suggest we all go and blow into the mainsail, or that some blow while others tie a rope to the back of the ship and pull forwards as hard as ever can be." He cackled for a short while at his own wit, and in doing so, the exercise being unusual with him, choked on a crumb. When he recovered, he found that Martin was telling Jack about the miseries of authors. Dryden had died in poverty. Spenser was poorer still. Agrippa ended his days in the workhouse. He might have gone on at very great length, for the material was not wanting, but that Mowat sent to report the appearance of a parcel of bankers on the starboard bow. They were of no great consequence from the warlike point of view, being fishermen from Biscay and the north of Portugal on their way to fish for cod on the Newfoundland banks, but even a single sail in mid-ocean was something of an event. Jack had often travelled 5,000 miles in quite frequented sea lanes without seeing another ship, and when dinner was over he suggested that they should take their coffee on to the forecastle to look at the spectacle. Killick couldn't actually forbid the move, but with a pinched and shrewish look he poured the guests' coffee into villainous little tin mugs. He knew what they were capable of if entrusted with porcelain. And he was quite right. Each mug was dented when it came back, and the captain of the head had to deplore a trail of dark brown drops the whole length of his snowy deck. It was not that the wind had yet increased, but during dinner the beginning of a swell from the south had reached these waters, and the Surprise's skittish roll almost always caught them on the wrong foot. By the time they reached the forecastle, the foremost vessels of the straggling fleet of bankers was right ahead of the Spartan, and in one view the eye could embrace the picture of peaceful, if rather slow and slovenly, industry and of striving war. Of one set of ships creeping in a formless talkative heap north-westward, while the other raced through them running east with the utmost efficiency as fast as ever they could move, wholly taken up with mutual violence. An hour or so later the Biscayans had vanished over the edge of the world, taking all philosophical reflections with them, and Stephen and Martin had retired below. But Jack Aubrey was still there on the forecastle, considering the chase, the frigate's magnificent spread of canvas, and the weather. He was also a little uneasy about her trim. She might be a trifle by the stern, and he was afraid she'd resent it if a full gale were to come on. "Mr. Mowat," he said, returning aft, I believe we may ship rolling tackles, strike the carronades down into the hold, and make ready to start maybe 10 tons of water from the aftermost casks, and pray ask the boatswain to have cablets and the like ready to his hand in case it should come on to blow. The glass is sinking. I'm just going to show the youngsters how to find whether the chase is gaining or not with a sextant, and then I shall turn in for a while. It was as well that he did. For with the rising of the moon, the wind increased, blowing straight into her round, foolish face and across the growing swell. By the time he came on deck, Mowat had already taken in the lower stunsails, and as the night wore on, more and more canvas came off until she was under little more than close-reefed fore and main topsails, reefed courses and trysails, yet each time the reefer of the watch cast the log, he reported with mounting glee, 6.5 knots, if you please, sir. 7 knots, 2 fathoms. Almost 8 knots. 8 knots and 3 fathoms. 9 knots. 10 knots. Oh, sir, she's doing 10 knots. With the courses reefed, Jack could see his quarry from the quarterdeck, see her plain in the bright moon. For though the wind was in the west backing a little south, there were few clouds in the sky, and those few were thin, racing, diaphanous veils, no more. The sea, though not yet really heavy, short and choppy rather than Atlantic rough, had a torn white surface, and the Spartan showed up strangely black, even when the moon was well down in the western sky and far astern. She had much the same sail as the Surprise, and though twice she tried a fore-to-gallant, each time she took it in. From time to time, Jack took the wheel. At this kind of speed, the complex vibrations reaching him through the spokes, the heave of the wheel itself and the creak of the rawhide tiller ropes told him a great deal about the ship. Whether she was being overpressed or whether she were bare a reef shaking out, even an inner jib hauled halfway up. He spoke little to the succession of officers who took the watch, Maitland, Honey, and the master, yet even so the night seemed short. At first dawn he took his first breakfast. The barometer had continued its steady fall, and although this could not yet be called a hard gale, it was certainly a stiff one and likely to grow stiffer. He decided to have his cablets sent up to the mastheads in good time, as soon as hammocks were piped up and he had both watches on deck. "I beg pardon, sir," said Mowat in the doorway, "but the privateer has taken a leaf out of our book and she's sent hawsers aloft." "Has she?" cried Jack. "Oh, the wicked dog! Come, have a cup of coffee to keep your spirits up, Mowat. Then we shall go on deck where virtue spooms before the goddamn gale, and our heaving wishes will help to fill the sail. That's drine, you know." On deck he found that the privateer had indeed forestalled him in fortifying her masts, and was now outstripping him in speed. With her full topsail she was already making something like 11 knots, or even more to the Surprise's 10, and she was throwing a spectacular bow wave as she did so, clearly to be seen some 3 miles away. "All hands!" called Jack, and down below came the cry, "Rouse out, you sleepers, rise and shine there, rise and shine! Heave-ho, heave-ho, lash up and stow!" This sending up of hawsers and cablets was a simple, even an obvious idea, and Jack had often wondered why so very few commanders resorted to it in heavy weather. But it was also time-consuming, and before the very powerful extra supports were made fast and heaved taut aboard the Surprise, the Spartan had gained horribly. She was now hull down, except on the top of the roll, tearing along under an extraordinary press of sail. "If a banker crossed her hawse at this moment," reflected Jack with his glass trained on her, "she'd sheer clean through." He sent the hands to breakfast, watch by watch, and began cautiously packing on, sail by sail. The ship's speed mounted. The whole sound, the whole vast chord of her motion changed, rising through 2 whole tones. And out of the corner of his busy eye he noticed all the reefers and many of the larboard watch along the weather rail and gangway eating their biscuit,
and grinning with delight at the flying, swooping speed. But he also noticed, and this was much more to the immediate point, that the wind was strengthening and backing farther still. This continued throughout the forenoon watch, and as the gale became more distinctly a southwester, so it brought racing cloud low across the sea. The dawn itself had been grey, but now really thick and dirty weather threatened. And although the Surprise had regained one of her lost miles by the end of the watch, she was indeed the faster ship in a heavy sea, Jack was very much afraid that if he didn't come up with the Spartan before nightfall, he'd lose her in the murk. Furthermore, as the wind backed, so it blew in the same direction as the growing swell, and the seas grew heavier by far. Both wind and swell were right aft by the time the gunroom sat down to dinner with their guests, Captain Aubrey and Mr. Midshipman Howard, and the ship was pitching through 41 degrees. All those present had known a good deal worse far south of the Horn, but even so it took away from the splendour of the feast. The gunroom had meant to regale their captain on fresh turtle to begin with, and then a variety of other delights. But the early extinction of the galley fires, put out as soon as the men's salt beef had been boiled, had reduced them to a cold or sometimes lukewarm collation. However, it included soused pig's face, one of Jack's favourite dishes, and treacle pudding, which he always said et better if it didn't scald your gullet. "You were speaking of the miseries of authors," said Stephen across the table to Martin, "but neither of us thought to mention poor Adamson. Do you know, sir," addressing himself to Jack, "that Michael Adamson, the ingenious author of the Famille Naturelle des Plantes, to which we all of us owe so much, submitted 27 large manuscript volumes relating to the natural classification of all known beings and substances, together with 150, I repeat, 150 others containing 40,000 species arranged alphabetically, and a completely separate vocabulary containing 200,000 words, and they explained, as well as detached memoirs and 40,000 figures and 30,000 specimens of the three kingdoms of nature. He presented them, I say, to the Academy of Sciences in Paris, and they were received with the utmost applause and respect. Yet, when this great man, after whom Linnaeus himself named the baobab tree Adansonia digitata, was invited to become a member of the Institute, a little before I had the honour of addressing it, he did not possess a whole shirt, nor yet an untorn pair of breeches in which he could attend, still less a coat, God rest his soul." "That was very bad, I'm sure," said Jack. "And I might have remembered Robert Heron," said Martin, "the author of The Comforts of Life, which he composed in Newgate, and many another more learned work. I wrote out his appeal to the Literary Fund, his hand being then too weak, and in it he truthfully stated that he worked from 12 to 16 hours a day. When the physicians examined him, they found him totally incapacitated by what they termed the indiscreet exertion of his mind in protracted and incessant literary labours." Jack's attention was, as to three parts, elsewhere, for the altered motion of the deck under his feet and the wine in his glass told him that the wind was backing farther still, backing fast with some nasty flaws and gusts. Several of the miseries and calamities of authors, therefore, escaped him. But he returned in time to hear Stephen say, "Smollett observed that had his friends told him what to expect in the capacity of an author, I should, in all probability, have spared myself the incredible labour and chagrin that I have undergone." "Think of Chatterton," cried Martin. "Nay, think of Ovid on the dank and fetid shores of the old cold black sea. Omnia perdidimus, tantum modo vita relicta est, pribeatut sensum materiamque mali. Yep, perhaps, gentlemen, said Mowat, beaming on them, there may be some happy authors. Both Martin and Stephen looked extremely doubtful. But before either could reply, a fierce, savage, triumphant roar broke out overhead, drowning the powerful voice of the wind and the sea, and just preceding the appearance of Calamy in his streaming tarpaulin jacket, reporting that the chase had split her foresail. So she had. And although she set her close-reefed foretopsail in the most seamanlike fashion, the Surprise gained more than a mile before she was running at anything near her former pace. Jack and Mowat stood there on the forecastle studying the Spartan. I wonder, murmured Jack. If he could gain 500 or 600 yards more, he could fire his chaser with some hope of cutting up her rigging, knocking away a spar, or at least holing her drum-tight canvas. With that done, he should certainly be able to lay her aboard before dark. The Surprise was now rolling heavily as well as pitching, but she carried her weather chaser so much the higher, and with very good gunners, dangerous fire would still be possible for a while. A veil of small rain swept between them, and the Spartan vanished. "I believe she'll wear it," he said. "Let the reefs be shaken out to the main topsail, and tell the gunner to stand by to try for the range." A solid packet of water sweeping from aft soaked him as he hurried bent low along the gangway, but he hardly noticed it. The air was full of flying spindrift, and it looked as though they were in for a thoroughly dirty night. He'd already shifted sail for the shift of wind, and she had a fine press of canvas. As the reefs came out of the main topsail, she heeled still farther, so that the deck sloped another 5 degrees, and his hand automatically reached out for the backstay. There was a pure, keen delight in this flying speed, the rushing air and the taste of sea in his mouth. He was not the only one to appreciate it either. The 4 men at the wheel and the quartermaster at the con had the same expression of grave pleasure, and when 2 bells in the first dog-watch struck a few moments later, the midshipman who heaved the log reported, 11 and a half knots exactly, sir, if you please, with a look of perfect bliss. And certainly, although the difference between 2 knots and 3 was neither here nor there, at this pace even 0.5 knot more made an immense change in the feeling of speed. It was also very hard to attain. But 2 bells already. That meant there was precious little daylight left. It'd be a damned near-run thing if indeed it could be done at all. And now in his glass he saw the Spartan starting her water over the side, 2 thick jets of it flying to leeward, relieving her of many tons. Right forward, just as the ship was reaching the height of her rise, the gunner let fly. At almost the same moment, an extraordinarily violent gust split the Surprise's main topsail. The men leapt to the sheets, halyards, buntlines and clewlines, and the moment he gave the order, the flapping, cracking, streaming sailcloth was gathered into the top, there to be masted, unbent and sent down. They laid aloft as though they were on a mill pond with never a breeze at all. At the same time, the boatswain, the sailmaker and their mates were rousing out a No. 2 canvas topsail and manhandling the awkward, unwieldy mass up through the fore hatchway. It was a most uncommonly rapid, skilful, efficient, seamanlike operation, almost without words, certainly without loud, harsh, angry words. And in the midst of his intense frustration, Jack was aware of it. But rapid though it was, it still took time. And there was the Spartan, fleeting away into the thick grey weather ahead. The sun, such as it was, would soon be gone. The moon wouldn't rise until the changing of the watch, and little light would she give even then. His only hope was to crack on. The gale, now stronger still, came roaring in just before the quarter, the Surprise's favourite point of sailing, and he was almost sure
that the gust that had wrecked the topsail marked the end of the wind's backing. He was almost sure that it would now blow steadily, though very hard. He might be wrong. The wish might be father to the thought. But whether or no, it was his only chance. On the other hand, was he going to run the ship onto the rocks of Ushant? He hadn't been able to fix his position at noon, and at this pace they must have run off a great deal of the distance. But then, with singular clarity, his mind presented him with a dead reckoning since the last observation. They were closing with the land, yet even at this rate they couldn't raise it before midnight. With his eye fixed on the faint and dwindling privateer far over the white-torn sea, he cried, "Fore to gallantsail!" It was only a comparatively small sail, but its sheeting home and hoisting fairly made the frigate stagger. Its force came onto her just as she was reaching the crest of a wave, and she changed step like a horse on the point of shying. Once she'd recovered her smooth, swooping pace, Jack stepped forward, laid his hand on the cablet sustaining the foremast, nodded and called, "Main t'gallant! Cheerily now!" She was already under single-reef topsails, and these two, so high, added immensely to their thrust. She was clearly gaining on the Spartan. But she was not gaining fast enough. At this rate, the Spartan would run into the safety of darkness before she could be laid aboard. And now there was no possibility of distant gunfire for anything but a ship of the line. Both swell and speed were now so much greater that green seas swept the forecastle every other heave. "Lifelines fore and aft," said Jack. "What? Come on now, come on, sir," cried Killick in a very angry whine. "Ain't I called out 50 times? Come into the cabin." His indignation gave him such moral superiority that Jack followed him, stripped off his sopping coat and shirt and put on dry, with tarpaulin hat and jacket over all. Returning, he took Honey's speaking trumpet and roared, "Stand by for the stunsails!" The men stood by, of course, but they looked aft, and they looked at one another with significant expressions. This was cracking on indeed. Yet even foretopmast and lower stunsails didn't satisfy him. Although the Surprise was now making very close on 13 knots, with her larboard cathead well under water and her lee rail hardly to be seen for the rushing foam, while her bow wave flung the spray a good 20 yards and her deck sloped at 35 degrees, he still called for the spritsail course. It was an odd, rather old-fashioned sail, slung under the bowsprit and masking the chasers, but it had the advantage of reefing diagonally, so that its leeward corner was hitched up out of the sea, and its windward half gave just that additional impulse Jack longed for. Both ships had their battle lanterns lit between decks by now, and both raced on through the rain and the spindrift in a dim glow. But when the Spartan began throwing her guns overboard, bright orange squares appeared as her ports opened again and again, for her leeward guns had to be manhandled across to be heaved out on the windward side, a shocking task in such a sea. Her boats were jettisoned too, lightening her still more. But, for all that, the Surprise was now running a full knot faster than the chase, and Jack felt confident that he should have her if only he could keep her in sight for half an hour. Yet there was murk ahead and frequent squalls, the certainty of an impenetrable night. He sent the sharpest eyes in the ship into the foretop and stood at the weather rail as tense as he'd ever been, watching the Spartan, her white wake, the suffused light from her stern window, and the low, dark clouds sweeping up from the south-southwest. 5 minutes. Her last two guns went over. 10 minutes more at this same tearing pace, or even faster, and she was not a quarter of a mile ahead. But nor was the dark, broad squall. She faded, and suddenly she doused all her lights, disappearing entirely. For a moment her wake could still be seen, and then that too was gone. The rain swept in flat on the driving gale. "She's hauled her wind!" roared the foretop. And the squall parting, there she was again, the faintest unlit ghost in the dimness, 5 points off her course. "I have her now," said Jack. But now the squall, clearing farther still, showed a great ship nearer by far, a three-decker wearing an admiral's top lantern, and more ships beyond her. And as the three-decker fired, sending a ball across the Surprise's forefoot, Jack realised that he was in the midst of the Channel fleet, and that the Spartan had slipped through them for breast unseen in the squall. He shot up into the wind, lowering his topsails on the cap, and made the private signal, together with his number and the words, "Enemy in the east-northeast." The three-decker replied, "Captain, repair aboard flag," and carried on her course. Jack had read the signal before it was reported to him. He looked at the greyness where the Spartan had been. He looked at the mountainous sea between him and the flagship, a pull of half a mile into the teeth of the gale, and caught Mowat's shocked and anxious eye. He opened his mouth, but discipline was too strong, too deep-rooted, and he shut it again. "Your barge, sir?" asked Mowat. "No," said Jack, "the blue cutter. She's more seaworthy. She may swim."